Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care, with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we will be talking about the past week's news-making event, Indiana's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, reactions in the food and hospitality industry, and the efforts that went into getting changes made to the law. Patrick Tam of the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association tells us about the challenges that the law has created for the state's hospitality industry. But the Indianapolis food scene also got some positive attention as well when one of the city's young chefs was named one of Food & Wine magazine's Best New Chefs of 2015. So we'll be talking with Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth about his experience in New York City this week for the announcement of the magazine's group of Best New Chefs. We'll also be back in the kitchen for a Cook This segment with Jonathan as well. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. As Indiana politicians, including Governor Mike Pence, found themselves in the midst of a national firestorm of negative reaction to the state's newly signed Religious Freedom Restoration Act this week, Indiana's hospitality community stepped up to fight the new law, which is seen by many as a means to discriminate against the LGBT community. Restaurateur Martha Hoover, for example, is holding a fundraiser for Lambda Legal, a national organization that works to secure full recognition of the civil rights of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgender people. Her restaurant group includes a half a dozen Café Patachou locations, as well as Petite Chou Bistro and Champagne Bar, Public Greens, and three Napolese artisan pizzerias. For the fundraiser, her restaurants that are open in the evenings, Petite Chou and the three pizzerias, will host fundraising dinners called the Great Patachou Sit-In to benefit Lambda Legal. A $100 per couple seasonal menu will include a shared appetizer, salad and pizza at Napoli's locations, or a shared appetizer, salad, and individual entrees at Petite Chou, as well as a bottle of wine and mini desserts. In addition, Hoover said, Uber has agreed to provide anyone dining at one of the dinners a special code for a free ride home. For Hoover, efforts to change or repeal the law are part of creating a welcoming environment for customers and staff. I'm lucky every day that anyone chooses to open the door to one of my restaurants, she said, and they need to be welcomed. That really is what the hospitality industry does. They welcome people. Restaurants are at the very center of the hospitality industry. Indianapolis chef Jonathan Brooks, who is one of Food & Wine magazine's Best New Chefs for 2015, posted on Facebook that his restaurant Milktooth will be holding a fundraising dinner as well to show the world that this legislation does not represent Indy. Some local restaurateurs are even switching ice machine companies in response to RFRA. State Senator Scott Schneider, Republican from Indianapolis, who is a co-author of the legislation, is a vice president at his family's company, Mr. Ice of Indianapolis, which leases ice machines. Hoover said that although she has worked with Mr. Ice for 25 years and leases 15 to 18 ice makers, she will be phasing out the company's machines. The core values of our businesses are just so different, she said. I don't expect everyone to agree lockstep with everything that I agree with, but added that, we are moving in another direction with a company that has a more open and tolerant view. A group of Southern Indiana chefs and food artisans who call themselves the Goat Kicks Back is also working on anti-RFRA fundraising efforts in conjunction with the Indiana chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Judith Shad of Capriole Goat Cheese, Susan Wilson of the Chili Woman, chefs David Talent of Restaurant Talent, and Daniel Orr of Farm Bloomington, David Fletcher of Blue Boy Cafe and Cakery, David Fisher of Fisher Farms, and Indiana University professor and Slow Food Bloomington co-founder Christine Barber, along with other Indianapolis chefs and food artisans, are exploring ways to offer products and hold events to benefit anti-RFRA efforts. So rather than boycotting Indiana restaurants and producers, Barber said, consumers can actively support those who are working for repeal. It's just a shame that these same folks are paying a price in lost business as they are held accountable by people outside the state for a law they neither passed nor support, Barber said. The economic damage from this unfortunate piece of legislation is going to hit people who have just dug out of the recession. Boycotts against Indiana and its products have been a real concern. Already, other states and cities had prohibited official travel to Indiana because of RFRA. Out-of-state celebrities have condemned the law. The band Wilco canceled an upcoming concert in Indianapolis, and conventions such as Gen Con are considering whether to relocate from the city. Chris Gall, Vice President of Marketing and Communications for Visit Indy, which works to bring visitors, conventions, and events to the city, said it will take a concerted effort to counteract the legislation's negative effects. I think it's going to take everyone in the community to rally and make sure the world knows that Hoosier Hospitality is alive and well, Gall said. It's something that our city's brand has been largely dependent on for some years, so it's absolutely essential that we get the word out that just because a bill has been signed doesn't mean that Hoosier Hospitality is gone. For more information or reservations for the Great Patashou Sit-In Fundraiser, contact Ashley at cafepatashou.com or call 317-202-0765 before 3 p.m. daily. Now, Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milk Tooth will be holding a fundraiser as well. Here's what he had to say about Milk Tooth's Big Gay Dinner Party.
I don't care to be super political, but it is an issue that's really close to my family and, you know, friends that are gay, employees that are gay, family that are gay, and I think in 2015 it just seems ridiculous that this is happening and that we have to even talk about it. So, I don't know. This dinner, I don't want to be uber political. It's more just a celebration and kind of a middle finger to anybody that would look down on Indiana for appearing to be something that I don't think it really is.
And that is a concern, you know, that it's kind of given the state a black eye, you know, and changed maybe how other people think about Indiana, you know, we've promoted that Hoosier Hospitality thing, and, you know, it's damaging that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's tons of social media out there and people just kind of bad-mouthing Indiana, and no one I know in Indianapolis has those views. And so it certainly doesn't represent our city in my mind, and it definitely doesn't represent the industry here.
Well, because the hospitality industry is a very diverse industry anyway, you know, very diverse, very welcoming, mm-hmm. you know, all sorts of people work in that. So it really seems to be hitting, you know, an industry that's already inclusive, which is really difficult.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're suffering from four beliefs that we absolutely do not have. It's just a shame, really.
So you're gonna kind of celebrate what we are, you know, and you know, instead of the things that we're not, that we've been mischaracterized as. So what kind of a dinner do you anticipate having?
You know, there's been so much awesome feedback, and everybody that I've talked to, you know, will do anything they can to be involved. So I think we're gonna have just a big parking lot party, possibly a drag show, because we want it to be fun. You know, this bill should not affect our sense of celebrating who we are or feeling ashamed to celebrate who we are or embarrassed about Indiana or who we are in Indiana and Indianapolis. So we just want to have a big gay fun party.
Well, this was certainly a challenging and difficult week for Indiana's restaurant and hospitality industry. Not only did the state have to deal with a law that proved to be discriminatory and divisive, but restaurateurs, farmers, and food artisans, as well as those in the tourism and event business, had to deal with boycotts and an overwhelming amount of negative publicity surrounding the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Under pressure from business, sports, the LGBT community, and from dismayed citizens, the legislature worked to pass another bill that made it clear that discrimination would not be allowed. In the midst of efforts to fix the offending legislation, I caught up with Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association President and CEO Patrick Tam to talk about the effects of RFRA on the restaurant and hospitality industry.
You've been working very hard on this issue, so tell me the economic impact of this. That is why this is so important, right?
You know, the state of Indiana relies, tourism is the sixth largest industry in the state. 14% of the state's employment resides in restaurants and hotels. And conventions and tourism, whether it's conventions, group business, or leisure travel, it's a big part of that. In Indianapolis alone, you know, we have a net present value that we've identified of what those conventions are at risk, and it's a staggering number, and a number that we're even afraid to talk about. But it is a significant dollar amount. But, you know, we're losing, you know, the small meetings, the small groups, so whether that's a small lodging property or a restaurant, a dining group, for dinner that evening in Tipton or Marion or Logansport or Jeffersonville or Indianapolis, that is lost wages. So hotels are losing those $50,000 to $250,000 in hotel meetings. So what does that mean? Well, it means housekeepers aren't going to be working as much. Servers won't be working as much. The bartenders will not be. There's less economic activity. In Marion County alone, 75,000 jobs are directly attributable to tourism. So what people have to realize is in Indianapolis, specifically here, we're the number one city for conventions per USA Today. We're a top destination for the New York Times of all places, which is great. But it's something we've worked hard to earn, and we've earned it. But you put that at risk, and there is a great amount of peril that it's real, very real. I mean, I represent, have the pleasure of representing a lot of creative chefs that are owners, and, you know, I talk probably more with owners and GMs. But at the same time, we represent the front desk clerks, the housekeepers, the person washing dishes. It's our industry. And most of our owners started out in those entry-level positions, willfully so. I started out in one of those positions in a restaurant as well. Our industry is about one of opportunity.
Now, restaurants are, the whole hospitality industry is very diverse. So talk a little bit about why you know, RFRA is important for you to deal with as you represent the hospitality industry.
And from the hospitality industry, I mean, we serve everybody. Hoosier hospitality has never been defined by law and legislation, never will be. No one in their right mind thinks that just because some law passes is going to change how our front desk greets you, how the hostess seats you, or where they seat you, and your food quality and your service. You're going to get great service in our restaurants. You know, restaurants specifically are one of the most diverse employment bases in the country. You know, 50% of restaurants are co-owned or owned by women. You look at our demographics of minority participation, our LGBT community that we represent, many of which are owners and leaders in our hospitality industry. You know, we are a diverse melting pot of everything. But the challenge, though, is that we represent such a diverse group, but at the same time, we serve everybody. And, you know, to me, as somebody that's grown up in Indiana and has three kids, and when my office gets phone calls and asks for, you know, they identify themselves as a gay individual, and they want a list of restaurants that they would be welcomed in, you know, they've been welcomed yesterday, they were welcomed today, and they're welcome tomorrow. Hoosier Hospitality is always that way, and it will not be changing. And that's the thing that we focused on with legislators is that, you know, no one can define Hoosier Hospitality in legislation. We define it as people. But at the same time, this has economic reality. Our state brand has been harmed.
Tell me how you started working with the legislature, the governor's office, to try to explain the impact of this legislation on your industry.
Sure. I mean, we're constantly asking for more tourism funding. We don't necessarily look to promote one location over another. We look to promote the entire state. And then as the state looks to promote, there's regional efforts as well. And then so we work with the state tourism office, the lieutenant governor's office, legislative leaders, and then all the tourism, you know, obviously first and foremost here in Indianapolis is Visit Indy, but you know, Visit Fort Wayne, we do restaurant weeks with. In Bloomington, we just did the first restaurant weeks there in Devour B-Town, which was great. We had all sorts of different types of restaurants participate there. And we're looking to make really pretty dramatic changes on how we do those for next year in 2016. But stay tuned for that. But the we're constantly talking about how tourism matters. And if there's one thing positive, if there you ever could say that, and I say that very sadly, is that I think a lot of people have woken up to, okay, tourism's real, and this impacts us. So we immediately, when we obviously acknowledge the situation with our customers, and we immediately start talking to legislators, people we talk to on a daily basis on behalf of the hospitality industry.
Now, talk a little bit about how real this threat has been, the idea that people on the outside around the country would boycott Indiana producers and restaurants.
Sure.
And products, because that is a real threat, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but that is true. I would like to remind people that, we're not treating customers anything different, and we never will. But it is real, particularly in the lodging industry. The lodging industry is always looking to book business in the future, and then they're always managing groups, which a lot of times they may be getting breakfast and lunch maybe inside the hotels, but dinners are when they go out and visit local restaurants. But once we knew those event planners and meeting planners, and then really the shareholders, the boardrooms, the sponsors, and we understood the reality. And we, some people, it took a little while, but not that long, to really show them and monetize what that value is. We have some great people, too, on the sales teams and properties and sales teams at CVBs, some of the best. And when people won't return their calls, when they're not getting RFPs, when they're being told that, hey, we were considering for that, but, hey, we can't do that now. And so it's a concern. But, I think that's where I think the legislators have heard that. Senator Long, actually just earlier today, stressed the economic reality of this. And that there is economic harm occurring, which I was sad to hear him say, but at the same time, I was glad he recognized it. Not everybody has a trust fund, and if they can't work next week, they don't make their bills. It's real, and that's where it's humbling to me to realize that, what happens in that state house does matter to those people's lives. And it's not those people. They're people I know. And like, joy, and respect. And, if they can't work next week, they're out of a job. And there's people that, restaurateurs, you have to be crazy to open up a restaurant, right? It's not easy. You may be lucky to get out of your restaurant for maybe 6 minutes in your first 6 months. So, half of them live there, basically. They have so much blood, sweat, and tears in their entire lives, not just financially. I'm talking about their whole soul wrapped up in that restaurant. But don't let, something that doesn't define that restaurant owner to harm them. And that's the thing that, when we talk to some people nationally, we go, look, this isn't who we are. You know what we are. You know why we're the number one place for sporting events in Indianapolis, why we're the number one convention experience, why we're rated one of the best family destinations in Fort Wayne. Why we get 3 million visitors in the dunes, why, Jeffersonville and New Albany do so well in their way, in Madison, Indiana, and Evansville. We can list, New Harmony, Indiana, of all places. So we've had people going there for decades, right? That's not who they are. I think that's where the national, international perception of this has really scared us, because we live on repeat customers. We want customers to come back. We live on repeat customers, word of mouth. A lot of our restaurants don't have multi-million dollar budgets for advertising, and so that's what we rely on. And
that's why our reputation is so important.
Yeah, it always comes back to what your mom told you. End your positive reputation with one bad decision or one bad act, and we're concerned that Rightly or wrongly, this is where we're at, and this is reality that we have to rebuild our state's brand, our local brands, and we do not want our brand of Hoosier Hospitality, which is viewed as one of the best in the world, to ever be challenged.
We've been talking with Patrick Tam of the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. Stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Even in the midst of the negative publicity that Indiana weathered this past week, a week that included other states and cities forbidding official travel to Indiana and restaurants and food artisans having reservations and orders canceled, there was some good news in the local food community. Jonathan Brooks, chef owner at Milk Tooth, a six-month-old restaurant in the Fletcher Place neighborhood, could finally announce that he was one of the Food & Wine magazine's best new chefs of 2015. Even though he found out about the honor a month ago, he couldn't talk about it until this past week when he flew to New York for the magazine's official announcement. Now, Jonathan will be featured with the other best new chefs of 2015 in the July issue of the magazine, which goes on sale in June. I stopped in at Milk Tooth this week to talk with Jonathan about the honor and about what it was all like.
So the whole New York situation with Food & Wine was totally unexpected. You know, we've only been open 6 months, but super fun, great time, happy to represent Indiana, happy to have a few days off.
You probably haven't had very many days off since you opened, have you?
Yeah, and really, I mean, not many before we opened, because there's so much involved getting this place ready, obviously.
So what was it like when you got the phone call,
I was excited, but... I didn't really believe it. You know?
Did they call you here at the restaurant?
No, Ashley was having dinner with my parents. I got done here and I went to Thunderbird to have some dinner for myself. And they called me right as I got there.
Well, that's kind of cool then. If you were someplace cool where you could say, did you say something about it?
Oh, no. I had to keep it a total secret. Yeah. So Ashley was the only person that I told. And also my front of house manager here and sous chef. They kind of had to know because... or else they were going to wonder why I was abandoning the restaurant for 3 days to go to New York and play.
So what happened? So you flew out to New York, mm-hmm. right? And then what?
So get to New York on Monday, and there's a little kind of meet and greet party at the Chef's Club, which is the restaurant Food & Wine owns. So we got to meet all the other chefs and all the people that would kind of be curtailing us around in New York. And everybody was really cool. Couldn't ask for a better group of chefs this year. Just young, enthusiastic, talented people that I was, you know, flattered to be included in.
How did that feel to be a part of that group? You know, did it seem real?
I think it'll. Yeah, it does now. I mean, right when we got there, obviously. It's a group of strangers. Some of us kind of knew each other, had some mutual friends, but no, just feel really lucky to be included. I know there's, you know, a ton of people in Indy that have worked just as hard as I have and are just as talented, but I'm happy to go represent Indiana. So then
what happened after that? So they introduced you all to each other and you had like the meet and greet, and then what?
And then they feed you alcohol. No, you know, just kind of get to know everybody. We obviously spent a lot of time together, kind of sharing our individual stories, you know, sharing a lot of social media stuff so that we could be connected afterwards. Definitely excited to go check out some of these other guys and women's restaurants if I have a chance. So that's what we did Monday, and then they took us out to Sambar where we had dinner, a lively, fun dinner for sure. And then Tuesday was kind of photo shooting all day for the Food & Wine.
Now, how was that? How was the photo shoot?
That was fun. You know, nothing I'm super experienced with, but fun. You know, good time.
Okay, and then there was
I think everybody that was involved had a sense of humor and could kind of laugh at themselves, and that made it nice. Nobody's taking themselves too seriously, or
but there was a big party then, right?
Yeah, then Tuesday night was the big Food and Wine Best New Chef party at the Edison Ballroom. So that was fun. Got to meet a lot of big name chefs. Go on stage and accept our award. Just fun.
So what was that like, meeting people that you've read about for a long time, maybe followed on social media, gone to their restaurants? What was that like?
It felt totally comfortable, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of, or at least for me, there was some nervousness with, being in front of a ton of people, and, I wouldn't say I'm shy, but I don't really enjoy the limelight. But to be able to meet the other chefs is actually really comforting, because, those guys get what we do and understand. I've been there before. So.
Well, and so it's kind of like a sympathetic crowd, because they've done all this. They had to be the new chefs at one time, too, right?
Sure, yeah.
All right, so how was that party? How long did it go on?
I think we were there from about 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock until midnight. So there was a good after party where, booze was flowing and we had some great appetizers and just kind of partied with each other for one last time.
Now, did you get out and about in New York any?
I did a little bit, yeah. I had some free time on Tuesday and went and checked out the Cannibal. Just kind of a beer bar meets butcher shop. Really awesome place to go eat by yourself. Drink some beers.
Had you been to New York much?
I went to New York about 5 or 6 years ago with Abby and John and some of our other friends from town here. And before that, I hadn't been back since, I took a family trip once when I was like 17 or 18.
So this was, you were really there as a professional in the national food biz, right? Mm-hmm. So that must have been a neat thing.
Absolutely. I think I definitely came back remembering how kind of spoiled we are here in Indianapolis, how much space we have in our restaurants.
Now tell me about that, right?
So cramped and tight in New York. Those guys work really hard in small spaces.
So what's next? So the magazine comes out in the July issue. It comes out in June, right?
Yep. So July issue comes out. Next week, Food and Wine will be here taking some pictures of Milktooth and our food. And then I think the big thing to look forward to is the Aspen Food and Wine Festival.
Oh, now that's right. So you get to go to Aspen.
Right.
Wow. How cool is that?
Everything I've heard, it's going to be an amazing time. And I look forward to seeing all those guys again. Really, I think we all kind of became pretty fast friends. So,
well, now that's nice. So now you have a group, that you're a part of. That must be neat.
Yeah, totally. I really look forward to going and checking out some of these guys in women's restaurants and seeing them again in Aspen and just talking about the experience.
So what are you thinking about being out there on the national stage? Because now you are, right?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about that too much. Just, the reason you get there, or what I can imagine is the reason that I was chosen, is based on just the day-to-day hard work that we do here and everybody at Milktooth's talent, not just me. So still about every day trying to make good food. But I do have a personal philosophy that it's fun to kind of just be in any room that you find yourself in. So any door that opens up to you, just to go check things out.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to say no to anything unless it takes away from the restaurant or my family,
All right.
But yeah, I'm all about checking out what's in the next room.
We've been talking with Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, one of Food and Wine Magazine's Best New Chefs of 2015. For more information on Jonathan and his restaurant, go to milktoothindy.com. Or look for it on Facebook, and check out foodandwine.com as well. So here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have an occasional segment called Cook This, when a local chef is asked to talk us through how he or she would make a dish with a surprise ingredient. And because local chef Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth was recently named one of Food & Wine Magazine's Best New Chefs of 2015, I wanted to check out again what he would do with a cut of meat that Goose the Market called a bavette steak.
I'm not sure yet. I'm thinking maybe some fried oysters, steak, maybe some sort of steak and eggs thing. But I might change my mind halfway through.
So what are you looking for? You just seeing what comes to mind?
Yeah, just thought. I have no idea. Seeing if anything jumps out.
It's so hard to know something.
If something's a good idea or a terrible idea. The line is so thin.
So what do you think?
We're going to do some beef tartare. Yeah, we offer a beef tartare here pretty regularly, and I feel like I have a little bit of a spin on it where I put some dry-cured salami inside for a nice texture, and we'll put some fried oysters on there. I think it'll be fun.
All right, so tell me what you've got and what you're doing.
So I got some flank steak from Jolene. I think I'm going to make a beef tartare, but I still might change my mind. I just realized the last kind of TV thing I was on, I made beef tartare. So maybe I don't want to do that.
Now, right?
I always like to season my meat
okay.
ahead of time.
All right.
Salt will really penetrate it that way. Then we'll give it a nice sear. And if you want really like evenly roasted meat, you always want to use a roasting rack. So that's what we're going to go set up right now.
Okay, so what are you getting instead? Okay,
Yeah, we're totally changing gears here. We're going to roast the steak, and then we're going to apply kind of like an Asian marinade after we cook it. So it'll almost be kind of like an Asian escabeche. And then we're going to serve that with some fried oysters. And the marinade will be like soy, fish sauce based, have some ginger, some garlic, and really spicy serranos. It's one of my favorite ways to eat steak.
All right, so now what's going to go in the marinade?
We're going to do some serrano peppers, some ginger, some garlic, some scallions, soy sauce, lime juice, sugar, and fish sauce. This is my favorite way to eat. It's more kind of like in the Italian style.
Yeah.
Kind of meat on the side with some minimal sauce. I'm really not like a meat potatoes guy. I like meat just kind of roasted, sexily dressed.
Okay, so tell me how you're going to cook it.
I'm going to sear it in a black steel pan, just in a little bit of oil. Baste it a couple times with butter, and then we'll go into the oven 350 on a roasting rack so it cooks kind of gently. I think that's like the biggest pet peeve I have watching like other people cook is that the temptation to be a little too handsy with your food. I mean, things that want to get crispy just need to just trust it. I'm not in favor of a really heavy sear. I'd rather have a nice kind of sexy, delicate piece of meat.
So now it's going in the oven, right?
It's going in the oven. I'm guessing it's going to take, in the convection oven, no more than 5-6 minutes to cook. While that's cooking, I'm going to chop some oysters, and we're going to garnish it with some fried oysters.
You got some oysters? What kind do you have?
Yeah, these are some Malpec oysters from British Columbia. We're going to shuck those, and then straight into some unseasoned flour. No need to bread them or salty enough on their own.
Now you've just got some flour, right? Just flour.
Yep, just straight flour. No salt and pepper. A tiny little bit of paprika. These are going to go straight into the fryer at 350 while our steaks are resting.
Tell me yucca. What you have.
We have some yucca, which is a root vegetable. We're going to peel it and make some chips. So this will almost kind of be like steak frites. This is one of my favorite vegetables to fry. You don't have to rinse it. You don't have to toss it in anything. You don't have to par cook it. Shave it straight into the fryer, and it gets crispy as hell. It's really good.
So how's it looking?
Looking pretty good. Still pretty rare. How do you like your steak cooked?
Mm-hmm.
Medium rare? These are really starchy, so they'll stick together. So you kind of want to deal them almost like playing cards into the fryer. It'll only take a couple of minutes.
they look good?
Golden brown. Pulling them out, they're going to darken a little bit when they come out of the fryer, so you don't want to pull them when they look like they're ready. You want to pull them just before they're ready.
So what were you thinking? Something you just went back to do something. What'd you go back to get?
I grabbed some sesame seeds. I thought that'd be kind of a nice nutty flavor in the our Spank Bank sauce.
So how do you think of the flavor combinations? Is it just, I mean, do you just know it by now? You just know it and you're not even thinking about it, or what?
The sauce is something that I made before that I'll use on anything from just like cold noodles to chicken wings, put it fish. It's just kind of a classic combination that I like. I don't know. I just like really just look at food and look see what's tasty to the eye and what you know is fresh and gonna be delicious.
Yeah.
Steak and oysters, classic.
Right.
Steak and fries.
So how long should something like that rest?
I think a good rule of thumb is like half the cooking time. I think that's what they say. So that probably cooked in total 7-8 minutes. So just let it rest for a couple of minutes.
So the oysters are going in the fryer, right?
Yeah. Yep, oysters dipped in flour, going to go right in the fryer. And very quickly.
So now how are you going to cut it?
I'm going to cut it against the grain, pretty thin. See how we did. I think we did all right.
That's beautiful. So what do you think about when you put a plate together?
You know, I don't get too deep with it, but you want it to look attractive. Well, you want everything clumped on top of each other. You know, especially with meat, you want to be able to see the meat. Unless you overcooked it. Then we'd be hiding it under the sauce.
So now you've got the marinade sort of thing that you put together early on, right?
Uh-huh. Yep, marinade's been kind of sitting and getting to know itself for about 15 minutes. Pretty quick.
And so now you've got the oysters out of the fryer, right?
Yep, got the oysters out of the fryer. We're going to set them kind of right on top of these little dollops of aioli that we have. That'll stick them to the plate. And that way when you pick them up, they'll already be dressed.
And you've got the yucca chips, right?
Uh-huh. We have some fried yucca chips.
Olive oil.
Yeah, and one more thing.
Okay. So what's the last thing?
The last thing, we have a little bit of living watercress. They're going to throw on there for a little spice. Not hot spice, but just a little pepperiness. There we go.
So now talk me through the dish. Tell me what it is and just a little bit about it.
So we have our roasted flank steak. We have a ginger soy fish sauce marinade, some yucca chips, and some fried oysters.
And it didn't take very long, right?
No, very quick. You can knock this out after work for a party. Pretty simple.
We have been in the kitchen with Chef Jonathan Brooks of Milk Tooth. You can check out the Milk Tooth menu at milktoothindy.com. Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health. With its 315-bed hospital and inpatient facilities and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Since we have been talking a lot about the current situation here in Indianapolis and Indiana with the restaurant scene, I thought it was appropriate to talk a little bit about what it has been like over the past 25 years. Now, Nouveau News Weekly, which I write for occasionally, just turned 25. And so they asked me to take a look back at the restaurant scene in Indianapolis over the last 25 years. So what first came to mind was, I still miss Renee's. Now, a lot of restaurants have come and gone in the 25 years since Nouveau launched in 1990, but the one I miss most was a little French restaurant and deli at 839 Westfield Boulevard in Broad Ripple. It was cozy and kitschy, with mismatched chairs and uneven floors, and located in an old building with plumbing problems and accessibility issues, but I loved it. That was my favorite restaurant for a long time, and one I went to regularly. You know, it worked for date night as well as lunch with a friend. But you know what was different about Renee's, even back in the day? It was non-smoking at a time when diners were routinely asked, smoking, non, or first available. The restaurant smoking ban is one of the best changes I can think of in the 25 years I've been covering Indianapolis. Although, to be fair, I wasn't really writing all that much about restaurants 25 years ago. I was an associate editor at Indianapolis Monthly at the time, and editor-in-chief Deborah Paul had handled the restaurant reviews. I was lucky enough to get to tag along occasionally, though, which was much appreciated, since the city's top restaurants were well out of my price range at the time. That's how I got to try Fletcher's American Grill and Cafe, which Fletcher Boyd had opened downtown in 1985. Unfortunately, I never did get to Peter's Restaurant, which had opened in Fountain Square in 1985, or Something Different, which had opened at 65th and Keystone in 1989. I think of those as the first wave in the evolution of Indy's current dining scene, the independent, chef-driven restaurants that were ahead of their time, where many of our current top chefs, somms, and servers got their start. It seems funny now to think that the city's old-school French and continental restaurants were still open when Nouveau began publication. They seem so much of a different era. But I did manage to get to La Tour once for an anniversary dinner and once to Chanticleer. The King Cole and the Glass Chimney were both still open then, too. And by 1991, a just-out-of-college Greg Hardesty had started working for Chef Dieter Puska at the Glass Chimney. But, you know, I never did get to either of those. The places I was going 25 years ago were more along the lines of Café Espresso and Broad Ripple, which is now Old Pro's Table. Or maybe we'd be drinking weak margaritas at El Matador at 921 Broad Ripple Avenue, which has housed so many restaurants since then, but which has always been a great place to sit outside. Downtown? 25 years ago, there were still restaurants in Union Station, and Circle Center Mall wasn't with us yet. Mass Ave was much more of a gallery district than it is now, although Basbo was already there, as were a handful of other bars and restaurants, including a cafe called Mugwumps, where bands would play in the basement at 608 Massachusetts Avenue, a familiar address for Pizzology and Libertine fans. Fountain Square? There wasn't much restaurant action there, although Peter George had certainly seen its potential when he opened Peter's there in the space that now houses Siam Square. By the mid-90s, I was reviewing for Nouveau, and I went to a lot of ethnic restaurants, places like Russia House, Cafe Europa, and various ristorantes that all seemed pretty similar. While the mid to late 90s weren't very memorable for local restaurants, that's when our farmers' markets started, and those have definitely made a difference. In fact, market vendors like Ross Ferris helped make it possible for the next wave of chef-driven restaurants to offer locally raised produce. And by 2000, the next wave of chefs began to open their own restaurants. Tony Hanslis with Tavola de Tosa and Greg Hardesty with H2O Sushi in 2000. Regina Mihalik with Our Bistro in 2001. Stephen Oakley with Oakley's Bistro in 2002. Hardesty again with Elements in 2003. Mark Irwan and Deirdre Henry with Taste Cafe and Marketplace in 2004. Brewer Ted Miller and his partners with Bruges Brasserie in 2005. And after Tavola closed in 2004, Neil Brown with L'Exploratore in that same location in 2006. And then something happened, or maybe it just sort of kept happening. Because even though Brown closed L'Exploratore in early 2009, by November of that same year, he opened his first Pizzology. From there, it seems, things just took off. In 2010, Hardesty opened Recess, and in 2011, another wave hit, and we saw Room 4 open, and Black Market, and Late Harvest Kitchen, and the Libertine Liquor Bar, and the local eatery and pub. And then Bluebeard happened, and Rook, and Milktooth. And then Peter George reappeared on the scene with Tinker Street. And now here we are, anticipating expansion of Rook, tacos from Neil Brown, another concept from Peter George, and you'd better keep an eye on the talent at Cerulean, too. This next wave is going to be good. You can find this essay and more of my work at nuvo.net. Well, we have talked a lot on today's program about restaurants, but there are also plenty of local food-focused events happening as well. For example, Indie Film Fest's Film to Fork series, which pairs thought-provoking, food-driven films with corresponding themed menus, is back for its third year. This year, guests will enjoy meals from the talented chefs at the Alexander Hotel before viewing the evening's film in the iMocha Gallery next door. The Film to Fork series has quickly become one of Indie Film Fest's most popular events, said Jason Romer, Indie Film Fest president. The themes regarding our food culture clearly resonate with our viewers and speak to the fest's main mission of creating a shared experience around film. Now, the series kicked off March 12th with The Search for General Tso, which I had a chance to see, and that film took viewers from Shanghai to the American Midwest, with several stops in between, to uncover the origins of the film's namesake dish. Now, the next film in the series is April 9th, and it's called Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon. It's the directorial debut of Mike Myers, and it tells the story of Hollywood legend and music manager Shep Gordon, who made his name managing rock stars, but is largely credited with turning chefs, including Emeril Lagasse, into culinary rock stars. Then on April 23rd, it's The Lunchbox, which is a bittersweet romance about a lonely housewife who hopes to get her husband's attention by packing a special lunch, but it unlocks an unexpected friendship instead. So all movies will be screened at the Market Table at 333 South Delaware Street in the Alexander Hotel. Doors open for cocktails at 7. Dinner is served at 7:30, and the film screening starts following dessert. Now, tickets for the films are $50 per person and include the dinner, a glass of wine, and admission to the film, and can be purchased at indiefilmfest.org. Now, for a more hands-on food event, check out a cooking class that's coming up hosted by the Indianapolis Vegetarian Society. So the Indianapolis Vegetarian Society and the host of a new web series, The Vegan Roadie, are teaming up to present this cooking class next Tuesday, April 7th from 6 to 9 p.m. to celebrate the release of an Indianapolis-based episode. The cost for the one-night course is $45 per person, with spots open for 16 registrants. The course will be held at Indy's Kitchen, the professional kitchen for hire located at 25th and Central Avenue. So for each episode of the program, the host, Dustin Harder, a chef, entrepreneur, and actor, visits a major U.S. city with his film crew to highlight vegan-only and vegan-friendly eateries and shops. So the cooking class features all vegan recipes collected from his travels so far. Nothing is better than pulling out of a town surprised that in the back of your brain you're thinking, I could live here, Harder said about his recent visit to Indianapolis. Now, the Indianapolis Vegetarian Society folks and Harder met when he contacted the group looking for a best-of version of their Indianapolis vegetarian and vegan-friendly restaurant list. And during the filming in Indianapolis, Harder and his crew visited Three Carrots at the city market, the Sinking Ship in the Sobro area of Meridian Kessler, and the Flying Cupcake and Sub-Zero Ice Cream on Mass Ave. Now, the Indianapolis Vegetarian Society serves as Indy's primary resource for vegetarian and vegan living and educates seasoned vegetarians and vegans, and as well as those simply interested, by hosting a variety of events and providing an active online community. They hold events throughout the year, so for more information on the events as well as the upcoming cooking class, visit indievegsociety.org. And don't forget that talented cooks with an inspired food or beverage business concept or an early stage business are invited to enter this year's Hottest Kitchen Entrepreneur Challenge, a regional contest to find Indiana's next great food entrepreneur. The challenge is sponsored by Ivy Tech Community College and by Reliable Water Services, a statewide provider of commercial water heaters, boilers, and water softeners. This year's contest features a startup category for those with a new food business idea and an early stage category for food entrepreneurs who've launched but are looking for help to get to the next level. Aspiring chefs, home cooks, and entrepreneurs can enter online at hotwater247.com by submitting a short application and uploading a photo of their recipe or product or concept. For contest rules and details, check out hotwater247.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thank you for tuning into the show this week. And thanks also to guest Patrick Tam of the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association. And thanks to Jonathan Brooks, chef owner at Milktooth and a Food & Wine magazine Best New Chef of 2015. And thanks to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care with a focus on patient-centered care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.